Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Tuesday Night with Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and we have a very exciting episode for you tonight. What better way to celebrate Pearl Harbor, but probably with one of the best political spy thriller writers out there right now, with Brad Thor coming on here in about 4 minutes. And then we will follow that up with C.S. Graham and some historical fiction. So we got a jacked or power jacked. I don't even know. We have a power-packed Jack show, I guess, for you tonight. I can't even talk. So I want everyone to sit back, relax, because 60 minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here on a live episode we have on Suspense Radio. Again, our hosts on this Pearl Harbor Day will be Brad Thor and C.S. Graham, and it's such a pleasure to be able to have them on with us. We want to let everybody know that we've been working hard for the last, you know, week and a half just trying to pound out this January Suspense magazine here. To get it all done, it'll be going to the printers tomorrow. You're going to have it on your shelves. Make sure you check out our Best of 2010 in the December issue, which is on the shelves now. So you want to check out your Barnes & Noble independent bookstores. If they don't carry it, tell them to email us. We'll drive there and give it to them if they don't have it. So make sure that you can pick it up. Or you can go on to suspensemagazine.com, order the magazine. We'll ship it right to you every month. You can have it right into your door. A lot of exciting things we have going on. We also have another guest that we're going to be talking about. Again, we're going to bring John Saul back on the radio. We had technical difficulties with that 30-minute episode, but we are going to have him back. And we just received word also in February we are going to, I don't have a date, but we're going to nail this down. We are going to have Laurel K. Hamilton on the radio show. Along with, in February, we are going to be able to have Stephen King on, but we're not sure exactly on which date that's going to be. Check out all of the episodes that we have here on Suspense Radio. You can listen to them all. We've had Patricia Cornwell, Tess Gerritsen, Steve Barry, many, many great authors that we had on. We just had our debut author night on here last Friday, so go for it. But with this Pearl Harbor Day, again, we want to welcome one of the best out there right now in the political spy thriller scene, none other than Brad Thor. He is here talking right now about his latest book, The Athena Project. So, Brad, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Hey, John. I'm great, and thanks for having me on the program tonight.
Well, I'll tell you what. It's such a pleasure. I mean, thank you for coming on because You, number 10, double digit here. The Athena Project is now your 10th novel. Did you think? What did you think? I mean, what do you think?
Well, it's very exciting because I wanted to do a – I had introduced the Athena ladies as kind of secondary characters in my thriller Foreign Influence over the summer, and I was really, really excited about them and wanted to give them their own book. So this for me is a lot of fun because it's based on real life.
Yeah, I mean, the Delta – I mean, you're talking Delta Force members here – and it's the brightest women. Now, that's something that is much different, especially in the political thriller genre that's out there right now. You got to kind of let people know, you know, how they came about and, you know, why bring them now in the Athena Project?
Well, this is a project I've wanted to do for a few years, ever since I first learned that Delta Force had this secret program where they were recruiting women to come in and get incredible training to go out and be high-end counterterrorism operatives. Basically, they were training them up very similarly to what they were doing with the men. And what's fun is they've been drawing most of these women from high-end athletic events. The Delta Force folks have been shadowing these events, tapping these women on the shoulder, saying, hey, how about leaving the sporting world and coming to serve your country? And when I learned about this and started digging in, it's highly, highly classified. There's not a lot of information out there about it. But what I was able to find out, I just said, you know what, this is just a fantastic basis for a thriller. And I wanted to do something different than my Scott Harvath series. And so that was the idea with this, was that it would let me explore some different things that I might not cover in my other series of books that I'm also still writing.
Now, when you say that you had to go and you had to dive in and there wasn't a lot of information because a lot of it is highly classified, is the stuff that you find, I mean, is it stuff that is kind of readily available to the public, or did you still have to even search for what you could find?
It's not – it's hard to get the stuff, and you have to know where to draw the line. You know, I can find a lot of people that are willing to talk to me off the record and everything to just kind of give some background color and stuff like that. But this is where the art of writing comes in because, I mean, these women really do exist, and the last thing you want to do is draw out a roadmap for the bad guys to be able to identify them and to target them. So I learned as much as I could about them and then said, okay, now I'm going to write this book just with a little bit that I'm willing to reveal in the book and that I was told was okay to put in the book, and then the stuff that I wasn't supposed to put in stays out of the book. But I think it works. I really think it works, and the response has been fantastic, all the way up to Warner Brothers is going to turn it into a huge, big-budget action film.
And here we go. Do you have any? Do they know who's already going to play who?
The deal just happened. We just announced it about 2 weeks ago, a little over 2 weeks ago. So I have not gotten to the casting stage yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to that part of the process.
And is it going to be based off of this novel, or are they going to do a totally separate screenplay for it?
At this point, everybody in L.A. has been talking about this novel and how much they love it. So it looks now like they're going to run with the Athena Project, and that's going to be the first one in this what we've been told is going to be an actual franchise for them, parallel to the Scott Harvath books. Warner Brothers didn't have a James Bond. They didn't have a Jason Bourne. And so they picked up my Scott Harvath books. That's going to be their new Jason Bourne franchise. And they picked up the Athena Project. So they're going to be doing two movies right out of the gate.
Wow. You want to talk about a great 2010 that you've had here. What better way than to have, you know, now your characters coming to life. And hopefully they give you a lot of leeway in order to let them know how you think that it should be going. So, you know, they don't, you know, screw it up, let's say.
Well, that is the hope. And, you know, before I go any further, John, I just want to say hello to all of the wonderful listeners that you've got in your audience, the folks from my discussion forum at bradthor.com that they affectionately refer to as the Thorum, and the folks that follow me on Facebook who are listening. And I've had that same thing said to me by all of them. Don't let Hollywood mess it up. And the thing is that as the author, you have to trust that the people you're partnering with are going to do a good job. And I'll tell you, the producers that we're working with, the development executive at Warner, and all of the wonderful people at Warner, they get it. They really, really get it, and they want to stay as true to the books as possible. So I'm very, very excited about what the final product's going to look like.
Now, you said something just a couple minutes ago that I thought was very interesting, where you said that some of the stuff had to be left out of the book. Now, seeing as how, you know, this is basically fiction, because people really don't know what's real and what's not real, and I don't think they really want to know that these things go on behind the scenes, you know, that could really be happening. I mean, is there really like a Jack Bauer in 24 running around L.A. and stopping, you know, L.A. from exploding 7 years in a row? But how would anybody really know, besides who told you not to put it in the book, that it was real or that it would, you know, or that it's fiction?
Well, you've got to assume that the bad guys are doing as much homework as I'm doing or more. So if you put a data point out there, if the bad guys have got A and they've got C and they can't figure out B, and they hear that I wrote this book and they read the book and all of a sudden B's there and it unlocks everything for them, you don't want to be the guy that gave that information to the enemy, to the bad guys. So this happens a lot, John, in my books, where I will sit down with the people, I call them my sharpshooters, who have helped me put the book together as far as the research and everything, and I'll give them a rough draft of the manuscript. And very often, I've gotten pretty good at knowing what's not supposed to go in, but every once in a while I'll have one of my guys say, you know what, whether it's one of my active military or law enforcement or intelligence guys or ladies say, you can't do that. That can't be in there. You're going to have to figure out some other way to express your creative thought there on that page, Brad. That's got to come out. And I respect that, and that comes immediately out.
Now, do you have to have some kind of special government security clearance in order to be able to do some of these? Because, you know, when you're thinking down writing these political and spy thrillers, and like you said, you might be writing A and C, and literally the bad guys could be picking up on B or, you know, something in your book, and you have to leave that out. I don't know. I mean, what kind of clearance and things do you have in order to be able to write these things?
Well, I don't have to have them vetted by anybody. So there isn't a review board or anything like that I have to put the books in front of, like some other people who have worked at the CIA in particular. They've got a very, very rigorous review process. But there are a handful of people who do look at my books early. And so they can see what it is I'm talking about and so on and so forth. So the idea, you know, it would be a crusher if somebody said, hey, the whole premise of your new book, you can't write that. You know, you figure out another thing to do. I mean, that would be a crusher considering, you know, it takes so much time to write one of these things. So I have got a key group of people that I run this stuff by just to make sure that I'm not running afoul of anything. And so far, so good.
Now, so when you look back here and you look back at the lines of Lurserine, which would be your first one, and now the Athena product, and now the Athena project, I can't talk, I don't get it right now. So now the Athena project, and you're saying, you know, as you're going through and you have to leave certain stuff out, have you learned from your mistakes from the Lions all the way up to the Athena on things? Like you said, now you've learned what you can and cannot put in. I mean, was that a big learning curve and process for you?
I think the entire writing process is a learning process. My goal is to get better with every single book, and that's what makes the job so satisfying for me, because it is so challenging, because I try to stretch myself. And like I said with Athena, I'm trying to do some stuff that people know me for and then add to that and do some other things and try to open up the Athena series to people that might not have read me before and bring them in. So as far as the learning curve on information and what I put in there, it's pretty fast. I learned early on the kinds of stuff that should not be in one of these thrillers. You know, Brad Meltzer, who's a pal, great, great author, Brad had said a thriller writer's job is to beat the headlines. And that's very true. You want people to read this book saying, oh, my gosh, I could imagine this happening on my doorstep tomorrow. And if your book breaks, hits the stores right at the time something similar is happening in the news cycle, that's even better for you. I mean, that's a godsend as an author. But you really do have to be careful. And, you know, you have to have the sensory acuity to pick up on what should be in, what should not be in. And, you know, you hang around with these people who are out there fighting the bad guys on a daily basis, and you learn very quickly just from sitting around and keeping your mouth shut and your ears open what kind of stuff they're comfortable sharing. And, you know, it gets to the point where they can just give you a look, and you know that look means, okay, Thor, what you just heard doesn't go in the book.
They give you the look. Yeah, like, yeah, I can picture the look now. You're like, yeah, I got you. Don't worry.
Yep, exactly.
So I mean, political thriller writings, you know, spy espionage, I mean, it's all kind of the same thing. You know, where does your passion come in to sit there and say this is what you wanted to start writing?
Well, you know, it's very interesting, John, and that's a great question. I have wanted to be an author since I was a little boy. And what's funny is, after I graduated college, I moved overseas. I'd studied abroad for a while in Paris, and I went back to Paris and started writing my first novel, which was a thriller. I just sat down and said, this is the kind of book I want to write. And I got several chapters into it and then said, you know what, I understand why so many authors become drunks and put guns in their mouths. This is such a lonely, solitary business.
Jeez.
And I sent my laptop back home, and I used the money I'd saved working in college to travel around. And I ended up creating a television show, a travel show for young people on public television. But all of that was me running away from what I really wanted to do. In my mind, I was saying, what if I take a year to write this book and nobody likes it? What if I don't get it sold? So on and so forth. So it's kind of a funny path. I did the TV show for public television for a couple of years, and then my honeymoon, my wife asked me, she said, what would you regret on your deathbed never having done? And I said, well, writing a book and getting it published. And she said, fine, when we get home, you need to start spending 2 hours of protected time every day and to make that dream become a reality. And that's what I did, and that was the Lions of Lucerne. But that passion has always been there. I really think that people write, authors write, because they have no other choice. I joke around, it's the only way to get the voices out of my head.
So you got a lot of voices running around in your head then, do you, Brad?
You know what? The stories bang around in my head. Things will stick in there for years, and I'll think, wow, that's an interesting something or other to put in the book. I mean, writers are really like flypaper for interesting facts. I've got a funny T-shirt that my wife gave me that said, careful or you'll wind up in my novel. And it's true. I mean, all my friends know that anything they say around me is fair game.
Well, you know, the funny thing is when you say that, I mean, because you're one of the people, since you have a lot of connections, that if someone wrote, you know, cut you off on the freeway or whatnot, you could probably take down their license plate, find out who they are, and then, you know, you can kind of write them in the book and be like, you know, there you go. Now I've killed you off in a way that I thought about when you cut me off on the freeway, and now I've done it in, you know, in my book, so that was to you.
I joke around about, you know, the pen is mightier than the sword, and my big joke is, wouldn't it be great to put such and such a person in there and have an errant cruise missile strike their house? That's the joke that I use. But that is kind of fun, and in writing throughout history has been like that. I mean, a lot of people have been able to do that, and that's where the expression, the pen is mightier than the sword, it's not for getting even with people, but it's an incredible leveler. And I'm not a big grudge holder. I kind of move past that stuff. But I do know some other thriller writers who will remain nameless that have got ex-wives and bosses and co-workers that just litter the graveyards of their books that have been killed off in the most grisly ways possible.
You know, I think that is – but you know what? I think that's very therapeutic. You might as well write it instead of actually doing it. And you know what? Like, again, if it's very therapeutic and it helps you out, I'm all for it.
Yeah, writing can be a very therapeutic process.
Right. Now, the other thing, so we talked about how you're getting into, like, the Delta and the four team members here of Athena and everything else. But on the flip side, when you're looking at the bad guys, now, we know that I believe back in 2007 you were able – or 2008, you were able to go and follow, you know, some of the – you were able to go over to Afghanistan and kind of shadow them a little bit. So how do you be able to go ahead and research the bad guy then on that side?
Well, that's a great question. I really like to study the great bad guys of entertainment. So whether they be in novels, whether it be on television. And one of the things I've come to learn is that bad guys who have depth are a heck of a lot more interesting for people to read about. Someone that has flaws. I always thought Tony Soprano was a brilliant kind of, I don't know if anti-hero is the right word. I really hate the mafia with a passion. And I never liked watching mafia-related video games. I didn't like playing mafia-related video games or watching television programs or movies, but I was drawn to The Sopranos, the idea that here you've got this really bad guy who's got a wife and kids and he's got to maintain his family, and he's got panic attacks. this idea that this big tough guy is somehow not able to master his own psyche, that he's wounded somehow, is fascinating. So when you look at doing bad guys, because you're right, you know, I can go spend time with guys in Delta or on the SEAL teams or something like that, but how do you do your research? Great question, John, for a bad guy. And I think what you have to do is imagine the worst thing that human beings are capable of, put that into a character, but then actually give them a vulnerability. Maybe even actually give him one thing, or her, something that's commendable, something that's laudable. And I think when you have that dichotomy, it can make for a fascinating character.
Yeah, and you know, and when you're just bringing up, you know, talking about the bad guy, and you, I think you almost have to look at a bad guy to say, what scares the hell out of me and what would do that in a bad guy? So, again, you know, when you're looking to say that you have maybe terrorism over here on this country's soil and doing things, what would then scare you to write about a bad guy that you would, you know, that whether it's true or not, that would just scare you half to death if all of a sudden you knew that this was real going on in the newspaper or something was going to happen here?
Well, so are you asking me for a specific thing?
Yeah, like something that maybe has not happened, but you know, I mean, no one could have imagined maybe, or maybe they did, about 9/11. You know, back in, you know,
right,
the planes hitting buildings. What would be the next step that could possibly happen that would scare the hell out of you? That could actually happen.
Okay, well, I'll tell you one of the things that I'm very worried about is the terrorists like to pick targets that are symbolic and that of America, and that can interrupt our way of life. And there's two things that I'm worried about. Number one, I know Al-Qaeda is planning their attacks based on the depth and breadth of media coverage they can get, and they'll get a lot more media coverage if it involves women and children. So I'm terrified about them hitting schools here. The other thing I'm terrified about is the shared experience we have of sitting in the dark in a movie theater. They don't even need any suicide bombers. You can walk into a movie theater with a backpack. And I have been saying this for years, that at some point these guys are going to do this. And they are going to, on a Saturday night across the country, leave backpack bombs. They're going to go into a big movie opening, leave backpack bombs, walk out of the theater. Nobody's going to even notice it. And across the country, in the blink of an eye, our way of life will have changed. We will never sit alone together in the dark again and watch movies. And if you own stock in Netflix, it'll go through the roof.
And that's one thing that I never thought of, but now when you mention it, how true is that? That, yeah, you don't really even look at the people walking into the movie theaters, do you? You don't even notice them. People don't even, I think a couple years after 9/11, I don't think people really notice anybody on the street anymore like they used to, unless you're maybe at an airport. I think that's the only time that people's radars go off.
Well, and that's the other thing. We've seen terrorists target airports, people at ticket counters, for years, back in the 70s in Rome, and even recently a few years ago in LAX at the Al Al counter. We saw the London and Glasgow with them trying to drive car bombs into the terminal. You know, we're very vulnerable outside security. As you sit there queued up waiting to get through the pat-down or the magnetometer or the backscatter machine, you're incredibly vulnerable. Same thing in the luggage carousel and baggage claim. It is very, very dangerous to be outside security at the airport. So that's another area. It's a soft target that, you know, I hope nothing happens. I hope none of this comes true, John. But, you know, if it did, would I be surprised? No.
Yeah, I mean, I want to remind everybody, we're talking here with Brad Thor about his latest novel, The Athena Project. It's bradthor.com to find out many information that you want to find out about Brad. Great website. Love your newsletter, the way that you connect with the fans. So I think that that's great. Another question then is, why have we been here a little over 9 years and nothing has happened again in the country? Do you have an idea of maybe why that hasn't happened yet?
Well,
that
I
was
think
the scare for a while that it was going to happen again.
Absolutely, and I think our brave men and women in intelligence, the law enforcement communities, and the military have been leaning forward into this threat. And they have kept us very safe. But here's the deal. We have to be lucky 100% of the time. they only have to be lucky once. I mean, we're so lucky that they nailed this Mohammed Usman Mohammed in Portland who wanted to blow up the Christmas tree lighting ceremony. This
right.
other idiot here in Chicago who wanted to blow up people coming out of the Dave Matthews concert at Wrigley Field. Faisal Shahzad, the chucklehead in the Times Square would-be car bomber. I mean, we're very, very lucky that we've either gotten close to these guys to give them inert devices, or that their own devices, like the Christmas Day bomber, Faisal Shahzad again in Times Square, did not detonate. Our luck at some point is going to run out. And, you know, our answer to 9/11 was to create more bureaucracy, more government, you know, the TSA and all this kind of stuff. You know, I would love to see returning veterans, particularly our wounded warriors, particularly at the airports, be put in a position to interview people standing in line waiting to check in. I think that that's something the Israelis do. I'd like to see here. I think that we've got great men and women in this country doing a good job. I think we can be doing a better job. I just hope it doesn't take another successful attack in America to make that happen.
Now, here's the question that I've been dying to ask for a while. You and Brad Metzler, who's going to actually be in our January issue, we were able to interview him, and he's going to be on the radio show, and Vince Flynn, the three of you probably at the top of, you know, the food chain here. Everybody aspires to be now political thriller writers. Are the three of you possibly going to get together and write a book together?
I
or maybe
see
just
it happen.
Two, or maybe just two of you. But are you going to collaborate at all? Is there going to be any collaboration coming?
You know what? I none of us have ever talked about that, and we're all so busy with our own projects. I know Vince is going to be co-writing stuff with Brian Haig, I believe, some point that was announced. At this point, you know, I'm doing two books a year. I'm not using a collaborator. I'm not using a ghostwriter. It's me writing. At this point, I wouldn't be able to take on a project like that as much as I respect the work of those authors.
So, I mean, I just think the fans, I think, would go absolutely nuts, especially, I'm just going to throw it out there, especially if it was, let's say, a screenplay for a movie where the three of you actually wrote a screenplay and put it out there. I mean, I think that would be, the fans would go crazy over that. Now, and I know it's very time-consuming, but, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, if we have to do a bucket list, that would probably be mine. I would love to see that, if we had to have a wish list.
Well, you never say never. Anything is possible, and I think probably one of the biggest motivators outside of wanting to make the fans happy, and I've heard this question many times from readers before. I think in addition to that, if there was an incredibly good cause behind it that was going to be the beneficiary of the success of a project like that, whether it was the Wounded Warriors project, something like that, I think that would be a big driver that no matter how much work, no matter how tough the burden, if it was going to benefit particularly the brave men and women who do so much to keep us safe and keep us free, then I think that would be the ultimate reward and enticement to do something like that.
And last question, I don't know if you heard the international thriller writers that they sent over, Steve Barry and James Rollins and David Morrell and Andy Harp, they all went over to Afghanistan. They did a nice blog about it and talking to the troops and talking about writing or anything, and, you know, all of those things. Is that something, you know, were you asked to do, or is that something that you were thinking of doing at one time, you know, coming up here in the future?
They were very kind and did invite me on the USO tour. And in the beginning, I had signed on to do it. And then the timing for my book, which was just published 2 weeks ago, the timing, we had to move up the deadlines and everything. And I was unfortunately unable to go on that trip. And I can only imagine how much fun those authors had and how much the troops enjoyed seeing them. So that's my big regret there. As much as I love Steve Barry and Jim Rollins, I can see them anywhere in the country. It would have been fun to be with them in Iraq, but it would have been even more fun to be with the troops and to be able to shake all those hands and say thank you.
Yeah, and we had Steve Barry on right after he got back, and we're going to be able to have David and James on the show to talk about their experiences too, so that was really good. But I'll tell you, and we want to mention, too, Foreign Influence, we said, was one of the best books of 2010 in our political genre field for Brad Thor. So keep it up, Brad. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
All right. So, everybody, again, bradthor.com, The Athena Project. It's out there with the new spinoff series. And bradthor.com. Again, Brad, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure. And, you know, two books a year, a lot of work to do. So we look forward to seeing him.
Well, John, thank you. And if I can add, I'm really loving Suspense Magazine. So if there's anybody out there listening who is not getting Suspense Magazine, you're missing out. Fantastic magazine. I highly recommend it.
That's what I'm talking about. Checks in the mail. I love you, Brad.
You too. You complete me, John.
You complete.
Thank
even
you.
Though you are a Bears fan and I'm a Vikings fan, you see, we can get along. We're just like that commercial on the Holiday Inn. I pick up your bag, you pick up mine.
Can't we all just get along? That's what I'm talking about.
I know, especially this year when my team stinks and your team's in first place. So I just got to put that right. All right, Brad. You have a great night, and you know, we look forward to seeing what's coming out next from you. So enjoy.
Great. Thanks, John.
All right. Have a good one. Bye bye.
Bye.
Again, everybody, that was Brad Thor, best-selling author here with his latest project, the latest book, The Athena Project, which is out now, just came out. And you can also pick up Foreign Influence, which came out here in 2010, which we listed as one of our best books in the political spy thriller genre for 2010. So Brad is definitely at the top of his game. This is his 10th book. BradThor.com is the website to check it out. And you can get his newsletter and find out a lot more about what Brad's doing. And I do recommend that you definitely pick up his books. If you haven't, you can start right now with The Athena Project and then work your way backwards or jump in wherever you want to go and keep it going. Like he said, now he's going to have two movies coming up. So we're going to be looking for that probably in the next couple years, I would say, just seeing as how Hollywood is. So we're going to go right over here now and we're going to talk with our next guest, which is authors C.S. Graham, which is actually made up of two authors they write under, and that is Stephen Harris and Candace Proctor. And I believe Stephen is the one that's going to be joining with us tonight. So I want to thank Steve for so much for coming on. How are you doing tonight? Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Steve.
Oh, it's good to be here. Actually, both of us are here.
We're both here.
Wonderful. Fabulous. And Candace, how are you doing? It was nice to meet you.
I'm doing great. Thanks.
VoucherCon.
Yes, it was fun.
And so the latest book, The Babylon Codex, is now available. Can you tell everybody a little bit about the background of the book and, you know, how things are going along with it and how, you know, the conception of it?
Well, this is the third book in a series that you can read them out of order, but they have the same heroine. It's a sort of a loose cannon CIA agent named Jax Alexander, who finds himself in a sort of an unwilling partnership with an Iraq war vet named Toby Guinness, who happens to be a remote viewer. And that is really the genesis of the entire series, is the remote viewing project, which was run by the United States government for several decades by both the CIA and the Army, as well as several other departments, and was a very real program that the United States government ran, basically using people with psychic ability to collect intelligence.
Now, with the two of you writing together, I think a lot of people like to know, you know, what parts, I guess, you know, does Stephen, what parts does maybe Candace do? You know, is it kind of a collaborative effort? Does someone kind of say, hey, I think we should do it this way, and then you kind of work it around like in a web, like walking down a road? How do those books kind of come together, especially here with, like, the Babylon Codex?
Well, the process starts out with a germ of an idea. You know, one of those what-if kind of things. And the two of us sit down and begin to build a plot line, you know, trying to string together a series of, you know, as all thrillers, you know, one disaster after another. And we create a multi-page plot line. Then we sit down and actually go back through and put together scenes to get us from one point to another in this plot. Then we go into phase three of this, and at this point, what we do is we'll begin to flesh out the scenes, maybe pieces of dialogue, pieces of action, and then once this is done, Candace takes this over. She's been writing for a long time, is a masterful writer, has another series under the name of C.S. Harris, the Sebastian St. Cyr historical mystery series. So she writes the text. Then we sit down and go back over it again to see if it stays, you know, true to the outline and see if we've got any little pitfalls and things like that. But this gives us one voice. It gives us an awful lot smoother, you know, product.
You know, and I think it's great because, you know, you always get that when you have one person that's doing it, it's always, you know, sometimes they miss things. And it's always nice to kind of have, you know, like my wife with the magazine, you know, we collaborate on doing everything because someone sees something from a different point of view and can point that out. And you'd be like, oh, I never even thought of that. What is such a great idea? You know, I think it would work going that way. Is that kind of like, that's kind of how you guys feel too, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's two minds are always better than one, and it's great to have somebody who knows as much about your book the book that you're working on as you do, so you can bounce ideas off of them. Steve is I couldn't write these books without Steve. Steve is the one who spent 21 years in Army intelligence, who ran agents in Southeast Asia, who worked undercover spying on Americans, you know, back in the 60s. He's the one who did, he's actually done all of these things that thriller writers like to write about and pretend they know what they're talking about, but he actually does know what he's talking about. He's done it all. So it's I couldn't do them without him.
And, you know, and that is the part of the realism that brings to your books, you know, starting with the Archangel Project to the Solomon Effect and now to the Babylon or the Babylonian Codex. That, you know, that's what readers like to know because it does make them, you know, authors have to create a fictional world, but the more truth that you can kind of put in that, like, you know, like our last guest, Brad, was saying that he was trying to put stuff in and they would tell him, no, you can't write about that. It really engages with them, and you're engaging with the readers back and forth.
Steve knows so many things. Like I'll write a scene with people with, you know, he's the expert marksman. He knows everything you wanted to know about guns and bombs, and so yeah, he definitely adds an element of realism that keeps me on track.
Now, have you ever sat there and said, you know, I really want to put this in. How can we make it happen? And you just kind of sit there and say, well, we can kind of do it this way, or we can stretch it a little bit and maybe, you know, work it in that way. Do those kinds of things, you know, come up a lot?
Yeah, we do these kinds of things. It's one of those, how do I get from here to there? You know, we'll, how do you get into this building? How do you get around this kind of surveillance system? Those kind of things, and you know, it. We do run into those things, and surprising—I won't say surprising—but every now and then, I'm challenged by reality. And Candy will sit there and say, "Well, why don't they just do this?" You know, some very simple approach, and it's one of those "duh."
Right.
So yeah, we had one scene when where we were going along, and. So I was talking about picking a lock, and she says, oh, you know, that's really interesting. How do you do that? So I went upstairs and rummaged around in some of my old spare junk and pulled out a set of lock picks, came down, and within about 5 minutes, she was opening locks.
Because a lot of people just keep spare lock picks in their old junk, I got to admit.
well, you know how it goes.
It was a talent I didn't know he had, that's for sure.
And probably you had, and probably you looked in that drawer and had no idea that that was even a lockpick that you probably were looking at anyway. I have no idea what it would look like. I see, you know, I used to watch MacGyver with the paperclip, and the guy could do anything with a paperclip.
I love that show.
it is the greatest show, and it, you know, a lot of that stuff is just so far-fetched, but it is a funny show. Now, when you're looking back and you see the Archangel Project and now through the Solomon Effect and now up to your latest book here, the Babylonian Codex, how do you think that you guys together have evolved moving forward? What's the biggest part that, you know, has taken you from back then up until now and now going forward?
Well, I think one of the things that's it's a challenge for us is that we've tried to keep a conflict or a tension, if you will, between Jax and Toby about this remote viewing. from the very beginning, he has been a skeptic. You know, doesn't believe that this is going on. You know, can't do this kind of thing. And then she continually, several times in each of the books, pulls something off using remote viewing. So he is confronted, you know, in every book with her success. And we've also written in some failures. But so this has been, it's been a growth. He is beginning to reluctantly accept her, but not necessarily remote viewing. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're facing as we go forward. We can't let this guy, because of the personality, we can't let this guy, you know, become an avid, rabid, you know, proponent of this, because then you lose that dynamic between the two of them.
And you mentioned the term remote viewing, and people can go on and read csgrahambooks.com is your website and see, you know, because you explain what remote viewing is. But for the people that are listening right now, just so can you just kind of explain to them a little bit about what that is?
Well, it's a sanitized name that was given to a technique by the government because they basically didn't want to let anyone know that they were spending taxpayers' money on psychics, there is a definite protocol that is involved that in where a trained remote viewer will sit down and go into a meditative state and focus his mind on a target, his or her mind on a target, which they're given, and then basically, by concentrating and focusing, be able to see the target, even if that target is on the other side of the world, and be able to not only describe it visually, but also to describe other sensory inputs like sound and taste and feel. So it's an intelligence gathering technique which has, in the 20, 30 years that they were running the program, they had some incredible successes with it. The problem that they always had with it, however, was twofold. Sometimes the remote viewers were incredibly spot on in their descriptions, and then other times they would have a complete miss. And there was absolutely no way that you could tell when the remote viewer was having a good session and when they were missing. And that's very dangerous when you're dealing with intelligence, because false intelligence can be actually more deadly than no intelligence at all. And because the kind of targets that they were running the remote viewers against, whether they were the inside of embassies that they couldn't go in, or military installations in the Soviet Union where they couldn't get anyone inside of them to verify what the remote viewers were reporting, it's, again, you can't... I think we saw in the Iraq War what happens when you act on intelligence that hasn't been verified. So it had a lot of problems, but it's a very real technique. And although the program was officially shut down in 1995, there certainly were reports coming out of England during the latest Iraq War that the British were still using the system, and there are rumors that the United States is still using it as well.
So officially, it's been shut down since 1995, but there still could be things that are, you know, still going on, which kind of leads me to the question of, you know, if the public knew everything that the government was doing, how scared would the public be?
What do you mean by everything?
Well, you know, because, well, the things that go on behind the lines, you know, you hear about, you know, a lot of this classified documents, and I'm sure that talking about the remote viewing, that a lot of this stuff is classified and you can't find this out. But now with the talk of all this WikiLeaks stuff coming out, if the people knew maybe how the government's working and the things that they do, whether it's Big Brother or anything like that, how scared do you think the people of the United States would be with our own government on the things that they do?
I think that there would be some concerns. I think that I don't know that I would say scared. I think there probably would be.
How about
some,
concerned?
Yeah,
concerned.
I think that's a varying, you know, from 1 to 10. That some people would be thrilled to death that we're doing stuff, and other people would be, you know, absolutely you know, petrified. I mean, all you have to do is look at the furor over the full body scan. I mean, there's an awful lot of people that go, hey, I don't have any problem with that. And then others are talking about, this is a horrible invasion of my privacy. It's one of those, you know, where you stand depends on where you sit in many, you know, in many instances. But I think that the people would be frightened in some instances. You look back at the church committee when they did the big investigation of the CIA and all of the things that they were trying to do, you know, the assassinations that they were involved in or attempting. And incidentally, church was a big proponent of remote viewing. But, you know, I think that one of the things that has always disturbed me, I can understand it, but it doesn't make me less disturbed about it, is that the reason for classifying stuff is very often not because we're afraid that the bad guys are going to find out what we're doing and counter it. Because that was one of the wonderful things about remote viewing, is there's no way to stop it.
Correct.
But they were honestly, in my humble opinion, hiding remote viewing as much because of the giggle factor as they were because it was a potential intelligence thing, is that they didn't want to have to go before Congress, you know, open Congress, and say, we're spending money to have people sit in dark rooms and imagine what's going on halfway around the world. It's going to create some very awkward situations, and it did.
Right,
all you have to do is look at the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Right. You have that listed here on your remote viewing as one of the other things to look at if people are interested in knowing more about it.
Yeah. They made a real joke out of it. The Albert Stubblebine character, the general, who kept mm-hmm. trying to walk through the walls. The guy's real. but the book
that I never knew. That I never knew.
Yeah. And you'll see him referred to, Albert Stubblebine, you'll see him referred to in an awful lot of the literature. I mean, the books that were published by a number of the people that were actually doing the remote viewing.
And, you know, and you say that the giggle factor and the things people be like, I can't believe they're doing it and this and that. Well, you can almost go back to, you know, seeing as how this is, you know, Pearl Harbor Day, we can always go back to World War II, where people now have always come out and said that Adolf Hitler for Germany was scouring, you know, the planet, trying to look for every religious artifact he could to give himself that leg up on, you know, things like that. And now people are looking at him as, you know, of course he was crazy, but just another form of him being crazy to try to think that, you know, he could get these religious artifacts to help him do what he wanted to do in conquering the world. And I think that that's kind of the same thing, where if they knew that our government was doing those things, people would be looking at us funny too.
Well, we do a lot of things that there's information coming out, have done things, information coming out right now on scientific experiments, medical experiments that we were doing on people without their the whole MK Ultra project. So I don't think that shining the light of scrutiny on government programs is necessarily a bad thing. I think it governments can really go off track sometimes if things are kept too secret.
Mm-hmm. And looking here at the Babylon Codex and looking forward, what can we expect in the future here with Toby and the remote viewings and the things that are going on? What do you got coming up?
Well, we're actually thinking about starting a second series. We'll keep this one going, but we've got some other ideas that we want to play around with too. We'd like to get the two series up and running concurrently. So it's early days yet. Too early to talk about that.
But it's something in the works.
Yes. Yeah. But the characters, Toby and Jax, have got an awful lot of stories left to tell. And what we've found is that a number of people have focused on some of some of the ancillary characters there and want to see them come back.
Like Andre from the Solomon
yeah.
Effect.
Yeah, there's a big fan club for Andre,
the Russian,
the FSB officer. And so we've got some things that we've kind of kicked around involving him actually coming back and asking Jax and Toby for help to do something.
Well, you know, and the fans do love to see that. The other thing that they always probably email you about is, you know, hey, can he get his own series? Or are you just going to bring him back in another book? You know, I think a lot of them love the character so much that they actually want to see, you know, him come on and do his own series. And I don't know if that's something that you're thinking of doing.
That might be tricky.
I don't know if you can have an FSB hero. That would be a little, you know, Arkady Rinko is probably in Smith's series is probably as close as you could get. But, they're fun characters to work with. And the situations that you put them into and how they react to them and how they get out of them is always an awful lot of fun. I think that's one of the things that writers really enjoy most is that they get to make up these stories as they go along.
Oh, absolutely. And when you think about it, though, too, when you're talking about having, you know, Toby and Jax going on and then picking up another series going on. And then, you know, Candace, you write under C.S. Harris. I mean, that's a lot of things to juggle and a lot of things to keep in your mind. How are you able to kind of juggle all that with your family life and your writing and even just keeping your thoughts kind of straight and I guess not confusing some storylines and say, oh, no, that storyline's in this book.
Well, I have to admit, I have kind of found myself at least mixing up character names a few times, but I'm not the kind of person who can write a contemporary thriller in the morning and then switch gears and write my Sebastian series in 19th century London in the afternoon. I have to I do one book and then I do the other book, and it's actually good, I think, to have the two very different series going, because it's very easy for a writer, once they've been doing the same kind of book for a while, I think it's very easy to get lazy and slip into a rut. So I find it very challenging because mysteries, historical mysteries and contemporary thrillers are two very different kind of stories with two very different kinds of characters involved. And I think there's probably some bleed over in that. I think that the thriller probably influences my mysteries in that I tend to make them very fast-paced with a lot of action and suspense. But I think switching back and forth, writing first one kind then the other, helps to keep me fresh and helps to revive my interest and keep me excited about what I'm doing.
I'm not sure that we could handle much more of that in terms of physical space either.
Yeah, the books are running us out of the house.
With the her mystery series, we have huge maps of London, you know, historical reproductions from the 19th century. We've got, you know, there's this gorgeous series, London Revisited, which is about a 10-volume book that talks about various sections of London, plus, you know, tons of other stuff that are piled around. And, you move it over into a corner when you start writing the thriller series and drag out all of your electronic warfare books and things of that nature and start researching those and the big piles of Google Earth, shots. Yeah.
I mean, I think the Internet has helped, you know, historical fiction a lot because you're able to get onto the Internet and you're able to find these things. Instead of, I mean, if you look back, Stephen, you know, you were in the military years ago. Well, the world has changed so much. Different countries have popped up that were never back there before. So it's tough for probably you to bring, you know, your memory back to say, well, this is what it looked like when I was there. But now it's changed so much in the last so many years. How much on, you know, site research do you have to do compared to how much you can just do from your memory?
You start with the memory. And then you go back to, to reference books, some old reference books. And then Google Books is wonderful for that. And then Google Earth. We had one chase scene that we had written in the plot line in Kaliningrad, and so we had in our vision of this thing is that the bad guys were going to be chasing Toby and Jax, and and they were shooting at them, and they were swinging around these curves and switching back and forth. So we whipped out Google Earth and looked at it, and the only road in existence that went from point A to point B was this die straight road that ran right down this beach. Hmm. And it was one of those, oh, shucks.
So a little bit of different change on that one, I would definitely say.
But, the internet has been a fabulous tool, and I can't imagine how anybody did these things. And in fact, people didn't. You look at the level of detail that's involved in, look at Brad Thor's books, the level of detail that he has involved in his characters, in their actions, in the settings, the gadgets that they use. This stuff comes, from somewhere.
Right. I mean, a lot of it has to be, whether it's a little piece of fiction to a little piece of nonfiction, that's probably more for the reader to try to figure that out. But I got one last question for you here. It came from a fan, and they would like to know what one piece of advice, and this is probably two authors that are asking this together, actually, what one piece of advice would you offer writers who would want to collaborate together and write a book?
Oh, well, Steve and I are husband and wife, and we have a very good marriage, and I suspect that we bring that kind of give and take to the writing. I've noticed that we have done is that we sort of each have our areas of expertise. And the person who's the expert in that, Steve's the Army guy. He's the intelligence guy. So that's his area of expertise. And sometimes I'll be coming up with an idea for a scene, and he'll just say no, they wouldn't do it that way. So I know to back off. Whereas I'm the one that has a lot more experience than Steve has in writing and characterization and motivations, and so sometimes Steve will be wanting a character to do something, and I'll say no, we haven't given him or her enough motivation to do that. So we've each sort of staked out our area of expertise, and I think it probably helps that neither one of us has a lot of ego at stake here. We're not competing with each other.
True.
What's important is the book. Our own egos have no place at all at the table when we're sitting down to try to plot something out, a new book or a scene. The writing has to come first. It's funny. Before I started doing this with Steve, I always said there was no way that I could ever collaborate with someone writing a book because I'm a kind of a possessive, controlling person.
Sounds like my wife. Just joking, honey. Just joking. So, well, I'll tell you what, guys, it has been such a pleasure to have you on tonight. CSGrahamBooks.com, the latest book is The Babylonian Codex. Everyone go out, pick that up right now. It's great for Christmas. Let's go stuff some stockings right now. So I want to thank you guys so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right, you guys have a nice night.
Good night.
So, that was C.S. Graham. Again, they were talking about their book here, The Babylon Codex. Before that, we had on author Brad Thor talking about his latest novel, The Athena Project. You can find Brad at bradthor.com. You can find C.S. Graham at csgrahambooks.com. You can find us at suspensemagazine.com, where our December issue is on the shelf and our best of 2010 list is out, with Patricia Korn from Rebecca York inside that issue. Our January issue is just going to be done. We're going to have that out about January 6th. So check it out. Look us on Facebook, on Twitter, on MySpace, on LinkedIn. I don't know. Wherever you can find the internet, you can find Suspense Entertainment Magazine. So until Friday night, I want to say thank you guys for joining us. It's been a great show, and we will see you all Friday. Bye.